Hi, everybody. This is Eve Harrow and Rejuvenation for the Land of Israel Network. Taping this show on August 26, 2016, the 22nd day of Av 5776, on 3 hours sleep, I'm warning you, okay? We'll talk about my trip to Italy next week, but it was a long day yesterday. But you're listening to the show for the first time, hopefully, on August 28th. I have a wine tour. If you're listening to this as the first time it's being broadcast, I will be in the Shomron with some very happy people, I hope, exploring the different nooks and crannies of the vineyards at the height of the season. So right now, though, because I did not want to miss the show, I am sitting with Rabbi Francis Nataf. Hello, Rabbi Nataf. Thank you for joining me on an Erev Shabbat on a Friday. And actually, the wine fits in perfectly with what we're going to do, because I've had the privilege of interviewing you before on the books that you write, Redeeming Relevance, and your new book, the book on the book of Deuteronomy in Hebrew Devarim. So first of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
And the big story here, one of the big stories is the sin of the spies, which I've been talking about anyhow for the last couple of weeks with Tisha B'Av. And a lot of that has to do with the grapes and the big bunches of grapes that they bring back. So when I do a wine tour, I feel like I'm pushing back against the sin of the spies, because now those grapes are very, very good. So first I'll tell my listeners a little bit about you, about yourself.
Sure, sure. First of all, you always blame the grapes. The grapes are always the problem. But in any case, what I do, I teach to different audiences, many generations, many situations. And I write, as you know, obviously. I do a lot of translation work these days, and I serve as associate editor for the Jewish Bible Quarterly, which is obviously an area of great interest.
Okay, so if people can get that, like on the internet, on the email?
Yeah,
that's what it
sure,
is?
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's online as well as in print.
Jewish Bible Quarterly. Okay, everybody listen to that in case I forget to circle back to that. What I've loved about your work for the past few years, and that's why every time you put it in a book, I asked to interview you, is that so many people think that the Tanakh, that the Bible is like these stories, nice stories. And the titles of your series, Redeeming Relevance, is so, it really speaks to me, because, and I notice so many people, because these stories are still so relevant. Things that happened 3,500 years ago still come back to us today. So what in particular, the book of Devarim, the book of Deuteronomy, what is relevant in that book? Maybe give us a little overview of the book itself.
Sure.
And what is still relevant for us today?
Sure. So for me, this book is the book of Moses. And it's fascinating watching this person develop as sort of the model for what a person can become. You know, all cultures have their cultural heroes. And when you think about it, who stands out in Jewish culture head and shoulders above everybody else? And that's Moses. And one sees his literally humble beginnings, where he wants to be quiet and refuse to say anything, refuse to step up to the plate at the beginning of his career in the book of Exodus. And this is a culmination of, according to many traditional rabbinic writers, in fact, going back to the Talmud, this is a book that Moshe authors himself, as opposed to the first four books. The first four books are attributed directly to God, giving Moshe what to write. Here, you have a very different approach, and you see Moshe, instead of saying, this is what God told me, but rather saying, This is what I heard. And it's in his own words and it's his own formulation. And one of the things we're going to talk about probably is that the perception of what happened is not the same as the more objective rendition of God. And nonetheless, God encourages him and brings him along to say, yeah, you can do it. That person, a human being, can actually have an active role of not only being the listener, but being the one who intuits the will of God so well that he can actually write a book in the Torah, which in my mind, when we think about what the Torah is, it's absolutely mind-boggling.
Is that problematic for some traditional Jews that this last book is divinely inspired, but not divinely written?
Yeah, it's a big issue.
That's been an issue.
It's a real interesting issue, and it's played both ways. Certainly, because we look so carefully at every letter, and various laws are brought down from the wording and from the lettering, So there is a lot of discussion. One of the people that has the most problems with it is the late Renaissance scholar, Don Itzhak Abarbanel, who was involved in the Spanish Inquisition, moved to Venice. He's really bothered by that, and he comes up with a creative solution. But and the one of the few things that I didn't bring out well enough in the book is fully his arguments back and forth on this. I sort of gave him short shrift. But in any case, it is an issue because there are, like, obviously you picked up, there are a lot of theological issues and legal issues that hinge upon the divinity of the first five books. So it's a real issue, and it can be played as problematic and something we have to somehow work around and say, well, it's not really Moshe that wrote it, which is what the Abarbanel essentially says. Or I think there's another way to play it and say, this is what God wanted. He wanted it to bring a book of divine inspiration into the first five books. And it was all the other books after the Torah. Everybody agrees that books are divine inspiration in the words of the prophets as opposed to in God's words. And that's not problematic because there's no law that comes out of it. We're not as careful with the wording. But here, you know, you have a book that works pretty much according to all of the statutes, meaning the standards of the Torah that we use in terms of bring out law, we use in the last book as well. So it's tricky. It's tricky and it's fascinating to me. And for me, again, what's so fascinating and so relevant is that God is saying that a human being can step up to the plate without becoming an angel, without becoming superhuman, without becoming a god. On some level, you know, that's one of the fears that comes up, is that Moshe will be elevated to a god. And as in our time, it's not so much of an issue. But they say that's one of the reasons, many commentators point out, that's one of the reasons we don't know where Moses is buried. Mm-hmm. Because the temptation to make him into a god and worship him is so present, especially in ancient times when that was so common.
So what you're saying is that the fifth book, this book of Devarim, could technically be like the book of Isaiah or Nehemiah. It could have been the book of Moses, like this is this prophet's book, but it's put into what we actually now call the five books of Moses.
Right.
So he even gets credit on the first four.
they say in Jewish tradition that whoever finishes something gets credit for everything. So it makes sense.
Right. Okay. But one of the things that, you know, in starting to read the book is I'm fascinated by perspective. Okay, like, I mean, we joke around, but anybody who's been in a conversation with anyone, not just your spouse, but with anybody, afterwards, sometimes it's you were like in two different conversations. The memory of what happened, who said what, is different. So here you have Moses's reflection on some of the events that have happened, kind of his reviewing of it, maybe before he steps out of the picture, in the first four books. And some of them are strikingly different from the way the narrative had it the first time around.
Right. So I'm unembarrassedly a postmodernist. I think that what you put your finger on is part of the Jewish tradition from the very beginning, that here you're presented with a very different view. We mentioned the spy story. That's the most interesting of the various renditions that differ greatly from what we have in the first four books. Moses gives you almost completely different story of what happened. Instead of his deputies, Caleb and Joshua, speaking in defense of the land of Israel, so we find that Moses was the one speaking. The spies are almost not there. They come and they give a good report. And it's the people that failed. And all of these are actually true. This is the fascinating thing, that Moses' rendition is presented as the truth, even though it differs from the truth that we have earlier on. That there are two coexisting truths. There are different perceptions. Both perceptions are true. There's too much information, just about anything, to give a scientific reproduction of what happened. And in any case, the way it's refracted on a personal level is necessarily going to be different. So here you have Moses presenting his perspective, and it gets the divine seal of approval. Your perspective is outstanding. It's not the objective divine perspective, but it's an outstanding perspective that deserves to be written and made immemorial, to just put it in that book, and Jews should read it year after year and integrate and understand what you were trying to tell from your perspective.
That is a huge idea. Okay. That there, no, but that there is no one truth, that it's valid. However you're seeing something is valid as well. What's so interesting about the sin of the spies, though, is that along the way, I mean, here we are knowing, look, we know the end of the book, most of us. Although I have to say that when Moses dies, spoiler alert, at the end of the book, I cry every single year because you realize the greatness of this man and what could have been had this not happened. But it turns out that he sees the sin of the spies as the reason for him not entering the land. Most of us are taught that's because he hit the rock instead of talking to it. But in his perception, this is what keeps him out of the land. That's a very big difference. How do you explain that?
Sure, sure. So that's one of the things I speak about in the first chapter of the book is that, and this follows really... I'm much indebted to a 19th century scholar and rabbi who's known in Hebrew as the Netziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. And he points out that Moses' vision was really of a different nature. He had a theological vision of an ideal state that he felt that the Jews were capable of stepping up towards. And he really pushed them hard towards his vision. It became clear pretty quickly that they weren't able to live up to that vision. And the scouts is the first major episode of the Jews saying, we have to slow down and we have to do things in a more human way. This miracle stuff is something that's really nice and exciting, but it's beyond us. And we don't want to just go into a land not knowing what's going to be. We want to do it like any other people, like we've seen everybody else do it. And Moses sort of says, okay, I'm willing to take a step back for you. I've seen a lot of positive elements, and I'm going to take this as, you know, in its most positive possible interpretation. He goes along with it, and he's shocked by the result. He's literally, the wool is taken out from over his eyes. I mean, he had an ideal vision of where the Jewish people were. And when he saw not only the report, but even more the reaction to the report, it rendered him literally speechless. We mentioned before that he said he's the one speaking. So one of the fascinating things in the story in Numbers, when it originally happens, is that Moses, if you look at the reaction, his reaction there is unprecedented. We have a Moses before the story that always is on top of the situations, whether it's turning to God in prayer, whether it's arguing with the people, whether it's disciplining the people, all of a sudden he's literally speechless. He doesn't know what to do. So much so that other people have to step up to the plate. You know, junior leaders come up and start talking because Moses is silent. And the only thing he's able to do, also for the first time, he falls on his face. He simply is powerless. He doesn't know what to do with himself because he sees that he's misjudged the people. What that means to him is that if he wants to lead the Jews into the land of Israel, he's going to have to do it on their terms. And it becomes clearer as time goes on that he's not capable of doing that. So he realizes that was really the turning point, that was the event that showed that they were in a different situation that he anticipated, and therefore they would need a different type of leader, not a super theologian and prophet that he was, but a more down-to-earth political military leader, which his successor, Joshua, was.
It's such a huge thought, though, that, you know, most leaders will do anything to stay in power.
Right.
And he is so in tune with the people that he realizes that he's not the leader for them, for what they want to do next. To follow the divine plan, they want to be very human. There's two things that occurred to me in what you were saying. One is, of course, you use the word scouts, which is really the proper word in the portion of Shlach Lecha, which is the sin of the spies. The word spy isn't used. Rigul is not used, l'ragel. It's used latour, which is, you know, to scout. So that's a very, very big difference. And the other one is, it occurs to me that, I mean, you spoke about how he becomes the leader, but his childhood is not with the people. He grows up in a completely foreign place, in the palace of the Pharaoh in Egypt. And yet he makes this huge turn to not only be the leader of the children of Israel, but be so sensitive to them that he understands when he can't be their leader anymore. It's a huge transition for this man. But one more thing, and then I want to get back to you, is this is the reason that I love books more than movies. Because when you're watching the movie, and we could say that the first time The Sin of the Spies is like the movie. Like, we're seeing what's going on, but we don't know what everybody's thinking. When you read the book, right, the author of the book is able to tell you, oh, and I did this because. And so that's almost what now this is Moses is saying, this is what happened, and this is what I was thinking when it happened. This is my perspective, which is just like, who gets an opportunity to do that?
Yeah, I think it's a very nice analogy. I just wanted to comment on one thing you mentioned, something that I speak about in my book on Exodus, which I wrote several years ago, about Moshe coming from the outside. In fact, I think that the name of the chapter is Moshe the Outsider. That in fact, that's on some level a positive characteristic for this particular leader, because number one, he can be more objective. In other words, it's very hard to be objective about your family. And a leader sometimes, especially if you're a national leader, you have to make decisions that are hard. And subjectivity sometimes gets in the way. In other words, you do have to have that connection to your people. It can't be completely laboratory scientific. But on the other hand, you also need that level of objectivity, which Moses was able to have by that distance. The other thing is that we believe in the Jewish tradition, and this is underplayed a lot, although it's coming back to the fore, is that the Jewish tradition is not just for the Jews. The Jewish tradition is really bifurcated. It's a certain doctrine for the Jewish people, but it's meant to guide and inspire the rest of humanity as well. And so Moses had to have both of those roles, and it's so critical that Moses not just be a Jew, right? That there be a universal Moses as well as a Jewish Moses.
And I think that's why, one of the reasons that his Egyptian background is really key and necessary.
Which sets the stage for the way we practice Judaism today, as like, we don't have the truth. Like, it's not that you're only a good person, you're only moral or only whatever if you're Jewish. Not at all. We've got a particular responsibility as the people of the book, as those who were given the Torah to disseminate around the world. But we don't think everybody should be Jewish. Quite the opposite.
Right.
And there's a goodness to humanity and a loving, kind God that belongs to everybody.
Right. Again, I think that shows the willingness to accept parallel truths, that there can be other truths for other peoples. One thing I want to mention, I'm not a radical postmodernist, that doesn't mean that anything goes. I think one of the reasons that people get into trouble who takes such a position is the sense is that, well, if there can be multiple truths, then anything can be true. That's not the case. There's such a thing as error. You know, there are mistakes. There are things that are unacceptable. But besides that, there are many possibilities. And to me, that is such a wonderful idea within Judaism. I think my favorite book from Rabbi Sacks is The Dignity of Difference, where he spells that out very eloquently.
That's funny, because I'm in the middle of reading his other book about religion and why, whatever, violence bred religion and not religion being, but that's for a whole other category. But you've mentioned postmodernism a couple of times. So maybe can you explain that? Because I don't know if everybody realizes the massive thinking, and I don't know if I would say changes in Judaism, but there's definitely a different way now of looking at the Tanakh, or a new perspective. I would like to say it's because we're living it again, because we're back in the land of Israel. So some of the Torah giants that you mentioned weren't here. And when you're here and you see the land and you see where things played out in the land, I think it definitely affects how you see our history. But how would you define postmodernism?
So my friend Susan Handelman once said that, what do you get when you mix a mafioso with a postmodernist? The answer is you get an offer you can't understand.
Okay.
So it's difficult to define it.
That's why I asked you instead of my defining it.
But essentially, I mean, the key word, which is one you've used a couple times, is the idea of narrative, that people construct narrative, people construct truth. And I think that is reflective of traditional Judaism in the sense that God and his will are too lofty for us to define and understand completely. One only gets a part of what God is and what he's saying. It's beyond us, being that we're finite human. And therefore, it opens up the possibility of more than one way of looking at things. And as we said before, the Torah presents a beautiful example of that. It's a difficult and complicated topic. I think in traditional circles, it's gotten a bad name. I think we're used to a Maimonidean vision of truth, even though he also admits that there's certain truths, the real important truths, that are too difficult for us to comprehend. But beyond those theological ideas, I think Maimonides, who was actually very influenced by Greek thought, which is much more unitary, that there is one, at least from my understanding, that there's one possible truth that we should try to attain. And, you know, there's nothing else. And therefore, you know, other religions are not wrong and therefore invalid. Whereas I don't think one needs to take that approach. And I think the mystics, I think if, especially if one gets into Rabbi Cook, Avraham Yitzchak Cook, who was influenced by the mystical approach very strongly, and he made a lot of room. It's interesting. I mean, he came to the land of Israel and was influenced by it, no doubt, but he also came from a certain space in European Jewish culture as well. And I think that the various cultures that he was exposed to and being impressed by the seriousness of other ideas and other faiths, you know, influenced and impressed him to present such ideas. So postmodernism remains, I think, a red word for many Jews. There was a rabbi who recently passed away who tried to bring it to the fore in Judaism, Rabbi Shagar, who was a student of Rav Kook and tried to present a postmodernist approach to Rav Kook and to Judaism. But for me, it's right there in the sources. I say, all going back all the way to the Torah. It's interesting that some of the people involved in postmodernism, at least in the American literary area, Daniel Boyarin, and I mentioned Susan Handelman, among others, were very connected to Judaism and saw the parallels, strong parallels between Jewish thought and postmodernist thought. So I don't know if that brings us any closer to understanding it.
Well, I mean, you mentioned Maimonides, and isn't it one of his tenets of Jewish faith that Devarim, that Deuteronomy that we're discussing, is divinely inspired? Like, that's something that he says you need to believe?
Yeah, so it's you know, once you get to Maimonides' theology, it's there's so much debate about it, and the academic world sees it very differently than the religious world, and there are people in between.
Right.
I'm not an expert on Maimonides, and though, you know, clearly he was one of the greatest, perhaps the greatest Jewish thinker post-Talmud, I've become more suspicious about his approach in recent years. Again, the Greek influence, I think, is not to be underestimated. Mm-hmm. And that critique's been made through the ages. I mean, in the past, I was more hesitant to take on such a view because of, you know, all the great things that Maimonides does and writes.
Right.
But you see people as diverse as, more recently, as Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch and Rabbi Nachman of Breslov also taking out a very critical view of Maimonides. So that one has to be careful. I think, especially in the modern Orthodox world, in the United States, where Rabbi Soloveitchik was really a Maimonides person, that it's really taken, you know, a over Maimonidean approach to the world, which was always difficult. I was always resistant to the thought of Rabbi Soloveitchik being influenced by the teachings of Rav Kook, and the two don't really go together so well. So I remain on the you know, if we want to divide between America and Israel and say that Rav Kook represents a more Israeli approach mm-hmm. to philosophy, and Rabbi Soloveitchik represents a more Western American
diaspora,
European
perhaps even
approach,
yeah.
then I'm on this, you know, I'm my right. feet are where I live, and my mind.
Your head, head too. Yeah. Well, and there's also the issue of context. I just went to during the week of Ed Herzog, of the right. tremendous Torah study of Dr. Lisa Fredman, and she gave a really interesting class about Rashi and the fact that the context of his life is the background of the Crusades. Sure. So she went through a lot of different proofs that he comes down very strongly on Esau, who is considered Rome and Christianity, and doesn't give much space there because he's living in a time where Christianity is just decimating the Jews. So definitely context, I think, with the great people. I mean, they're living a certain thing and they're seeing things through that reference. So back to redeeming relevance. So there's the sin of the spies, and there's how Moshe Rabbeinu sees it through his eyes. What else stood out for you in the book as you were writing this?
So I look at the beginning of the book and the end of the book as the most central parts of it. On some level, that's always what people look at.
Right.
One of the things that I found fascinating is Moses' blessings to the Jewish people. It's fascinating because one should compare it to the parallel blessings that Jacob gives at the end. It's at the end of the first book. And here you have the end of the fifth book. Blessings to, in the case of Jacob, is to all his children, and to, in the case of Moses, to all the tribes that come from these 12 children. Though, interestingly, one is omitted, Simon mm-hmm. is omitted. But that is less of what interests me, though it's certainly worth discussing also. Then one of the things that Moses does is to reorder them, but he also does something which I think is even more significant, and that's to change who gets the big blessings. So for Jacob, it's the two most obvious characters when you think of Jewish leadership. So one immediately thinks of Judah and Joseph. I mean, those are the born leaders, and they show themselves. And interestingly, their descendants in the desert show that they're part and parcel of that tradition. And, you know, who are the two scouts that right. buck the trend? They're from
Caleb Judah. Is from Judah, right. and Joshua is from Ephraim, which is Joseph.
So right. that's happening. And nonetheless, Moses keeps the blessing for Joseph, but takes it away from Judah and gives it to Levi, which is fascinating and highly significant. I think Moses is giving a message to Jewish people that it could be that Judah is the best temporal leader, but it's not the ideal. Don't think that having a nation like every other nation, where you have effective leaders, is the end all. It may be a way to survive. Again, Moses wanted to bring the Jews into the land of Israel in a very elevated supernatural way. And so at his death, he says, you know, I'm not giving up on that. I know you guys have chosen otherwise. You're going to go with Judah. You're going to go with David and Solomon. And, you know, they're great people, but it's not the ideal. And I want you not to forget that. I'm going to put it at the end of the Torah. You're going to read it year after year. And you're going to understand, if you're careful and you read it properly and you buy redeeming relevance, you're going to understand that this is not the ideal, that really the ideal state is a state where people are guided not by the sword, by the enforcements of law, by the police, but rather by inspiration and by teaching.
Well, the Levites are his tribe.
That's right. Well, that's also true.
Which is interesting, yeah.
But he creates a role that wasn't there. As in the time of the proto-Jews, the 12 children, so there wasn't that role. There was, you know, the role of the leaders, this type of leadership and that type of leadership. And Moses single-handedly creates, that's not true, with his brother and sister, mm-hmm. create a new model of leadership. And they say, you know, leadership is not just political and social leadership. Leadership is even more importantly about education and inspiration. And you need to remember that's really the bottom line. That's what the Jewish people is about. You may not be able to, you know, materialize it and make it happen immediately, but always keep that as your goal. I wrote something, you know, something that I'm fond of, that true vision, true dreams are setting things up that are almost impossible to fulfill. But that's what inspires people. If you set things that are too easy and too lackadaisical, you know, you can attain it, and that's great, but you don't inspire people that way, and you don't drive nations, and you don't inspire peoples to, you know, strive for the very best. And that's what Moses wants to do. He has one last chance to do it, and he does a lot of things, but at the very end he says, okay, I want you to remember that I had to give in this round, but I don't want you to give in to your lower selves. Mm-hmm. So keep striving for the best.
And perhaps that's also the charge to remember to build the temple, which is the Levites and the Kohanim.
Sure.
Are going to be running the moral leadership, if you will, the centrality of God. So yes, there's the dirty work of kingship and having to fight wars and having to, you know, plant or whatever it is, the day-to-day. Mm-hmm. And how to make that relevant to today, of course, is the fact that we've come back and we've got political leadership and we're doing pretty well on statehood with, you know, with all its challenges, given especially the neighborhood that we're living in. But we still have that to accomplish. Exactly what Moshe is saying at the end of his life is where we are today. Like, don't think that this is the be all and end all, that we have the state of Israel and we have an army and we have perhaps some kind of physical stability. That challenge that you're mentioning is still there, is still to come. And we need to be working on that, maybe especially now that we can relax to a certain extent. Like, we're all eating in the country right now. I'm a Jewish mom, so that's going to come in, right? You know, 100 years ago, you couldn't really worry about more esoteric things because people were starving to death. And now God's given, I see that totally. He's given us that. So now maybe this is the challenge that you're mentioning, is that we shouldn't forget and shoot for that.
Sure. Yeah, it's really easy to, when you relax, to relax completely.
Yeah.
And find other things to fill up our time with. You know, there's just so many
distractions
possible with social media. I mean, It's incredible. You know, before that was television and whatever it is, people find ways to waste their extra time, and I'm the same as everybody else. We're all plugged in and connected, and it's unfortunate. But one of the great things about the Jewish tradition is that week after week, you know, the Lubavitcher Rebbe used to call it living with the times. What's living with the times? Reading the Parsha of the week, reading the, you know, that
right.
That week after week, at the very least, we at least have to confront a section of the Torah. And one of the goals of my book is to say, okay, we're doing it anyway, and there's so much that we can get out of it.
Oh,
so let's do that. Let's, you know, at least the little thing that the Jews have to do, and you know, again, one of the beautiful things of the Jewish tradition is that we disconnect for 25 hours once a week, which is such a gift. And the more the world becomes cluttered, the greater a gift it is. Such that, you know, a lot of people want to try it.
Right.
But it's very hard once you're connected. You know, I know during the 6 days of the week, people expect you to respond. If you're, you know, if you don't respond right away, It's a problem. You know, people don't want to have anything to do with you because you're
right.
Just slow.
But for those 25 hours, we're listening to something else.
Gift that, you know, it's accepted within our community, and other people also understand that there is such a thing. So it's somehow legitimate on Shabbat to disconnect. You know, just reading about Stephen Hill, who actor in America, who also would take Shabbat off, and many others write about it, that for them, you know, it's just a separate space. So we have this separate space, and we have this beautiful book that we have to connect to. And unfortunately, so many of us waste that opportunity.
Right. You know, we or see it as a burden instead of
right.
a gift.
You know, it's because we chant it. And so therefore, it's very easy to turn off and not think about what's being said. And some books and some sections are more difficult than others. Deuteronomy being one of them. It's not an easy book. I read the introduction that was harder to write. And it's going to be harder for the reader to read because the more difficult book, as is the last book which I'm writing, which is Leviticus. But there's so much there if you work at it. One of my friends, when I was struggling with writing these last two books, with Leviticus and Deuteronomy, told me that, you know, you don't have to write the book. It's okay. Mm-hmm. There's no obligation just because you've written three books that you have to finish the series. And I heard that, and that was really liberating on some level. But my response inside was, besides my personal desire to finish the series, there's an even more important reason to do that. And that's because we don't just read three books a year. You know, we go to the synagogue, and it's specifically in those difficult books of the Torah that people need the most help. It's not so difficult to get into the stories in Genesis. I mean, they're exciting. They're interesting. You know, everybody's been writing about them for ages. So that's easy, and I found the task easy. But when you get to laws and when you get to speeches, which is what these two books are mostly about, and I speak about Devarim. Devarim means words. It's about words, a lot of words.
Right.
So it's hard. So there is where I try to do what I can to help others and look at different aspects of these words to bring out the beauty as well as the relevance.
You go out on speaking tours and explain the books? Give us a little bit of information on that.
I have a local circle in 2 weeks' time. I'll be in Efrat, as I think you know, in a couple of weeks, in Ramat Beit Shemesh and Har Nof. And I'll be going to the United States at this point, perhaps other countries, but in the formative stages of planning, we'll be in at least in the United States in November, the beginning of November.
And you speak to Jews and Christians?
I speak to everybody, whoever was brave enough to hear me.
So how would someone get in touch with you if they're wow, we've got to get Rabbi Nataf in here?
I'm not difficult to find. I have an unusual name so that it's easy to Google me. Not, you know, when you plug in Francis Nataf or even Rabbi Nataf, that's N-A-T-A-F, you don't have many other people.
It's not Moshe Cohen. Right.
So I'm easy to find. And I have a website, so, you know, it's easy. It's Francis Nataf, www.francisnataf.com. But again, Google's the best place. If you forget, if you don't have a pen on you, just Google my name. Even Rabbi Nataf will get you there, and then you'll be sent to my website. From there, you can just connect. I speak to all groups. Traditionally, more Jewish groups than non-Jewish groups, but I've spoken for non-Jewish groups as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, now I think that a lot of non-Jews are realizing the relevance of the Tanakh for them as well. It's not just the Jews' book.
Sure.
There's a lot in there for everybody.
Sure.
So this might be a great way, people, are you listening?
That's right.
To be introduced to texts that are not so simple in English, right? This isn't like you didn't write this in Hebrew and then it was translated into English. It started off.
And that's what we said at the beginning. You know, this is a book that's meant for all peoples. And I'm interested in spreading and sharing, really, the Jewish approach, as well as hearing other approaches to it. I think that it's there is a distinctively Jewish approach. And it's interesting that Christians, going back at least 600 years, have been studying with rabbis, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Rabbi Sforno in Italy was famous for having study sessions with Christian scholars, and he wasn't the only one. That the Jewish approach is not just coming from a dry reading of the text, but it's coming from a tradition which has a certain angle. Again, we're speaking about narratives. I'm not embarrassed, and I think it's impossible to see any book outside of a tradition. I've spoken about that before also, Stanley Fish, again, who was a famous literature person, also coming basically from a postmodernist approach, speaks about interpretive traditions. You know, it's fascinating, I think, for anyone, especially when we're talking about faith communities, to hear and understand how other communities read it. And in our case, and I don't want to say that we've got the owner's manual on the Torah, but we were the first nation, first group to connect with the Torah. So that does give our reading a certain interest and a certain priority in the sense that it was the first reading.
Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's a fascinating book in the sense that it's so full of our losses and our reflections, not on our successes, but as you said before, always on the goal. What is the next thing that we can attain? We're never satisfied with where we are. We're always looking for something else, which is just the way people should be in general, on a personal level too.
And it's challenging. It's challenging, and you know, anti-Semites throughout the ages, certainly more recently, have said, you know, we don't want that challenge. Jews challenge themselves, but by implication, challenge others. I think that's in the last book that I wrote, in terms of Midian and Moab, nations that Jews interact with, and have both tremendously positive interactions. They, you know, some of the greatest Jews came from these people.
Well, David, comes from Moab at some point, right?
And yet, both of them were tremendous enemies of the Jewish people. So it's fascinating, sort of contrast that specifically from the nations that have, you know, interaction and positive connection with the Jewish people, yet become their greatest enemies. And I see that, again, as sort of a reflection of, you know, anti-Semitism, and its flip side is that a lot of it is coming from the challenge that the Jews are sending to receptive peoples, and that challenge is you can be great.
Right.
And some people are afraid of that.
Right.
They'd rather say, I don't want to be great, and leave me alone. And that's what's going on historically.
Right.
You know, in these first interactions with great peoples, Midian, Moab, we see that they can churn out great individuals, and it's coming specifically from their national culture.
But what do people do with their greatness? You can be a genius at many different things, and you can, like, let's say Germany of the last century, the genius that came out of there, the most cultured country in the world, and they turn it to genocide and to horrible things.
That's right.
So that's a challenge we all have with whatever God gave us as individuals and as nations.
Right. And I write that about Joshua, by the way, that it's also a chapter in the book. Why is he connected with Amalek? Because his connection comes way before he's chosen as the national leader. And one of the things that I say is that he's going to be the military leader, and he has to see how not to do things, because the temptation of Amalek is really tremendous to just cut corners when you're on the battlefield. I mean, we all have to cut corners, but serious moral corners. Which is what Amalek does. It says, you know, give me the weak, you know, I'll just take advantage of anyone, hit them below the belt, I don't care. You know, as long as I can win and get the spoil, that's what war is about.
Use chemical warfare, some of the things we're hearing
this
week about Syria.
That's right. And Joshua was put front row and center. God and Moses both put him front row and center and said, I want you to look at how these people wage war, because you're going to be tempted to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there are indications in the book of Joshua that he is tempted.
Right.
Because it's so easy and it's so scary to be in war. And you're going to say that I don't care about the other people because they're our enemy.
And anything goes.
And anything goes.
Right,
exactly.
But it's not.
So Jews also have these temptations. The greatest Jews have temptations. We're all in the same game on some level. We're all human. We all can strive to tremendous greatness, and that's what the narrative of Moshe and his life is about. And we can also reach the lowest depths, and that's what the struggle with Amalek is about, and realize that we all have that potential, Jew and Gentile alike, and we have to be on top of it.
And that's Yisrael struggle. The struggle.
That's
what it's
with
all about.
With, God, right?
With man and with God. Thank you so much, Rabbi
you.
Francis Tuff. And selfishly, I'm so glad there's still one book that you haven't written, so I know I can get you back at least for one more interview when you finally get to Leviticus. Thank you so much for joining me. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thanks to Ben and Tabitha and everybody at the Land of Israel for allowing me to bring to you such wonderful personalities, and I hope you got as much from it as I did. So this is Eve Harrow on Rejuvenation. You can write to me, eve@thelandofisrael.com. And I will be heading to the States in September to the East Coast. And December looks like more the West Coast. So get in touch. Take care, everybody. Goodbye for now. This is Eve Harrow, host of Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. My maternal grandparents, Grandpa Morris and Grandma Lily, came to the United States from Russia over 100 years ago. they belong to the Mizrahi movement way before there was even a state of Israel. The Land of Israel Network is powered by the Mizrahi World Movement.
Hello, my name is Tommy Waller. I'm the founder and president of HaYovel. More than 12 years ago, I made my first trip to the Land of Israel. What I saw and heard changed my life forever. I stood with Nir Levi, an Orthodox Jewish man, in his vineyard in Samaria on the Mountain of Blessing. There, he opened his Bible and read the prophecy of Jeremiah that said, "You shall yet plant vineyards on the mountains of Samaria." This fall, during the grape harvest, we have the opportunity to join Israel as it celebrates the 50th year of the liberation of Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria. Come join us as we witness the unveiling of prophecy in the Jubilee year. Come be a part of the biblical narrative. Go to HaYovel.com, that's HaYovel.com, to find out more. And I hope to see you there.